From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When asked about the volatility of the stock market on Tuesday, President Donald Trump said during his press conference in India, "If I don't win, you're going to see a crash like you've never seen before." Trump has bet his presidency on solving economic woes for ordinary Americans and has touted the buoyancy of the stock market as evidence that he's lifting up all Americans. He's pointed to the official unemployment rate, which has remained low. But a deeper examination of the actual economic health of ordinary Americans, which is not the same as the stock market's health, paints a very different picture. A new year-long report into economic inequality shows that the reality is at odds with Trump's rhetoric. Specifically, under Trump, in almost all states, real median household income growth has fallen over the past 2 years. Joining me to discuss it is Jessica Goodhart, senior reporter for Capital and Maine, who's working on the report, which is titled The United States of Inequality, 2020 and the Great Divide. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Sonali, for having me on the program.
Let's first talk about the report specifically on Trump and what has happened under his rule over the past 2 years before we get into the bigger project. So I mentioned real median household income growth. In a piece that you wrote, you describe this this conclusion. What was your research?
So what we did is we looked at median income growth during the first 2 years of the Trump presidency, during 2017 and 2018. That's the most recent year for which household income data is available. And what we found offers a stark departure from Trump's characterization of how well middle class Americans are faring. You know, as you said, the reigning narrative is that the economy is doing great. The stock market is soaring, true, and unemployment is very low. But what we saw in his first 2 years, in 2017 and 2018, and that's the most recent data that household income is available, is that income growth for the typical household has slowed dramatically. When you compare it to the last 2 years of the Obama presidency. So middle class incomes grew at a rate of 2.7% from 2016 to 2018, compared to 5.8% growth rate when accounting for inflation. And in fact, growth slowed in 48 out of 50 states when compared to the prior 2 years. And in all of the major battleground states.
So I want to dig into those numbers a little bit because it's so important for, you know, those of us who are not economists to understand these terms. When you say real median household income growth, does that mean that for, say, my household, my family, the two incomes between my husband and I, over a period of time, whether that income is growing fast versus whether it's growing slowly, not whether the income itself is growing? Am I being correct?
Right. So we're in an economic expansion, and we have been for a while. So we would expect our incomes to be growing. And so what it means is that your incomes are growing, yes, but prices are growing at a faster pace. And so, you know, what Thea Lee from the Economic Policy Institute told us, and we conducted this analysis with EPI, is that, you know, at this point in the business cycle, wage and income growth for working households should be accelerating. It should not be slowing. And, you know, we've also seen tepid wage growth for middle income households. And there's a sense by some of the economists we interviewed that Trump and Congress could really be doing more to lift up the middle income households across the country.
So why is there this decline in the rate of growth under Trump?
Well, I mean, one of the things is that, you know, presidents generally claim too much credit and get too much blame for how the economy is doing. But the economist that I talk to say that he's squandered opportunities to lift up middle-income working and working families and working families. I don't know if you remember, there was talk of an infrastructure bill, right? Of investment in infrastructure. We haven't seen that. What we have seen is the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which was, $1 trillion investment where the benefits, most of the benefits went to the richest 5% of, or almost half the benefits went to the richest 5% of Americans. And so, you know, there have been some missed opportunities to help people in the middle and working class people.
One might almost suspect that Trump doesn't care as much about middle class Americans as he does about his wealthy buddies and the people in his strata of the economy. In your articles, you say economists say Trump has squandered opportunities to support greater gains for middle class families. And in some cases, he's backed policies that have worked to counter their interests. Okay, so the infrastructure bill didn't work out. The tax reform bill worked to enrich the wealthy. But what has Trump done to actually, to back a policy that has worked counter to the interests of middle-class Americans?
That's worked. One of the things we wanted to do was to talk to people in addition to looking at data. And one of our reporters, Kalina Tomhave, talked to folks in the state of Wisconsin, where income growth has really slowed. She talked to a man named Dan Sanderson, a software engineer who says that his medical expenses are outpacing his income. He's got medical bills he's still paying off, and has been forced to look for very expensive insurance. That is a state that is really struggling. Their dairy, he actually has a side business working for dairy farmers, and that have been really impacted by agribusiness. And so, that's a state that is really struggling. And it's also a state that was struggling even before, if you recall, that the prior governor of Wisconsin was Scott Walker, who Laura Dresser from University of Wisconsin-Madison argues sort of laid the groundwork for declining median income growth with a bunch of policies like an attack on public sector unions. So, I mean, not everything can sort of be put at the feet of Trump. There's been a lot of things happening in this country sort of leading up to where we are today.
Well, it seems as though it's part and parcel of the Republican agenda at large, whether it's state-level Republican governors and legislatures or the federal government under a Republican president and a Republican-dominated Senate, that seems to invest in the health of the stock market and the bottom lines of corporate executives rather than directly into ordinary household incomes. Is this just this failed idea of trickle-down economics at work again? If we just keep pumping money at the top, it's surely got to trickle down to the rest of us, except, of course, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is a year-long series that we're doing, Sonali, and so we have a bunch of articles. And one of the subjects we interviewed, a guy named Chuck Collins, who's really concerned about this issue of economic inequality, he described the country as being on extreme inequality autopilot. So you can come into the office of the presidency, the thought is, and do pretty much nothing. And people are going to struggle more and more because it's, wealth accumulates more wealth. And so I think that's part of the point. You have to look at not only what, president has the power that he has or she has, and limited power. Congress has the power it has, but if you do nothing, people will struggle more. You know, if you don't raise the minimum wage, which Congress hasn't moved to do since 2007, people will struggle more at the bottom.
So the research that you did showing that a real median household income growth has declined in these 48 states, they include some of these pretty important swing states, so-called swing states, that Trump won in 2016. We're talking about Florida and Michigan and Wisconsin. These are states where Trump is counting on voters seeing real increases, real gains in their day-to-day lives, bigger incomes, maybe better job security, in order for him to win re-election. But if your research is, it seems like it's a much more accurate view of what's happening on the ground, I imagine that there's likely to be a lot of voter dissatisfaction in those states.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends, you know, it depends on how, on what lens people bring to the economy and how they view it. As we know, that's a complicated political science question. But certainly, we know, and I know from having been in some of these states, that there are a lot of people who are struggling. I think about a woman I met in Erie, Pennsylvania, who told me that, you know, I met her in a Walmart parking lot, and she told me that she had $250,000 in medical debt, and she voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 in the primary, and then she voted for Gary Johnson in the general. And so you never know, right? You never know how things are going to go and how people's economic stresses are going to line up with their voting. Or I've met people who are really struggling, a guy living in a trailer, paying $100, you know, a month to rent part of a trailer. And he was a staunch Trump supporter. So, you don't know exactly how that's going to line up with people's voter preferences. But, you know, I do think it is interesting to see that the Sanders message, which is, you know, his brand, is that, you know, economic inequality is a problem. It's clearly resonating with a portion of the electorate, these early primaries.
Now, the maps that you point out that you created in your research to show the different, to compare presidencies of Trump and Obama and in how real median household income growth shot up under Obama and fell under Trump. These are quite interesting because, of course, Trump has often felt it, you know, important to claim over and over again that he has been far better for the economy than Obama, that he has done much more for ordinary Americans than Obama ever did. What was it about the Obama economy that led to those gains?
One of the things, so I've heard a couple things. So one of the things, so one economist expert I interviewed pointed out that there was more investment in infrastructure under the Obama economy. And I looked, and this is a story that's coming out tomorrow that people should check out at www.capitalmaine.com. There's something called the Job Quality Index, which is really interesting. And I think it was unveiled late last year. And basically it tracks the ratio of high quality private sector jobs to low quality private sector jobs that get created in the economy. So there hasn't been anything like that before. That, you know, there's always the jobs report, but like, how many good jobs are we actually creating? And so this is an index that's trying to measure that. And so this is something that a consortium of, you know, research groups have released. But nobody sort of looked at it in, you know, comparing the Obama and Trump expansions. And we did that. We kind of zeroed in on those dates. And what you do see is that during the Obama years, more good quality, you know, compared to poor quality jobs were being created. The other thing is that the Obama presidency benefited from this prolonged period of low inflation, which is, you know, again, this is, these are inflation adjusted numbers. So that's just sort of like some, you know, sort of good luck that the Obama presidency, you know, had. So I think, you know, I think there was, so there may be a couple of factors, but I think that people should definitely check out the story that we're publishing tomorrow. And what that story is going to look at is how people fared in the economy in the bottom 20% of households, you know, who are making the poorest households. And it's the same pattern. Those folks are all also saw slower income gains than in the top, same as the, for the median households.
As part of your research, you a few months ago also pointed out how the issue of healthcare impacts American households. A poll after poll shows that healthcare is the top issue for American voters. It's something that deeply impacts people's bottom lines, whether it's very, very high premiums or lower coverage or just the inability to get any coverage at all, or just, you know, having one massive medical issue that throws them into bankruptcy, whether or not they have health insurance. What can you tell me about what you found around the lack of access to quality healthcare and in terms of inequality in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue and something that we're going to look at more deeply as we move through the series, which runs is going to run through November. I mean, people are, there's incredible economic insecurity around healthcare. I mentioned to you the woman I met in the parking lot who had $250,000 of medical debt. We are constantly talking to people and telling people, you know, telling people stories who are struggling with the lack of medical insurance. And I think that's part of what we want to do is not just kind of go through the data, but talk about it. I met somebody in Detroit who was actually had voted for Trump in 2016, and he was a diabetic, and he was an employer, actually. He had health insurance for his employees, but he couldn't afford it for himself. And we were watching the debate together, and he looked up at the screen, and he saw Sanders. This was early. This was one of the early. This was when the debate was in Detroit, and he said, "Oh, the old that oh, there's that old there's Bernie." He says, "I kind of like that old gentleman," and and he was considering voting for. He had decided he didn't like Trump anymore. That he was what he said to me. Well, you know, when you think about it, everybody's from somewhere else, and so he was considering voting for Bernie. But so you know, we're finding stories, and one of the things he was impressed by was actually that Bernie had taken people over to Canada to buy insulin.
Right.
So we're just finding stories like that. I, you know, all the time. It's central, the insecurity people feel around not having healthcare, having inadequate healthcare, is really central.
And then it's no wonder that some of the so-called centrist or moderate Democrats who counter every claim that Medicare for All is important with, well, how can we pay for it? It's no wonder that that claim or even those queries grate on people's ears who have struggled with this issue so deeply. A new Yale study showed that a Medicare for All program would save 68,000 human lives per year. And the response by the Buttigiegs and the Bidens and the Klobuchars time and again is, well, how are we going to pay for it? 68,000 Americans per year, you know, would live if we were to have Medicare for All. So it seems as though the desire on the part of most Americans is to see this massive inequality that we're spiraling down into be addressed somehow. Trump has paid lip service to it, but in reality is providing cover for just the opposite. And then you have a whole bunch of candidates who feel the pre-Trump status quo was just fine. And then you have a couple of candidates such as Sanders and Warren who are trying to reverse that. Is that a good summation of where our political landscape is right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I think that's in some ways a good summation. I mean, just to sort of continue with the story of this voter, what I sensed when I talked to people, this was really early on, and this was in Michigan, which is such a critical state. I felt like he was really interesting to me because, you know, aren't there, you know, it's actually kind of hard to find those like Obama Trump voters, and he was one. Trump, yeah, he voted. And so he was that kind of swing voter, that's the coveted swing voter. And he said to me, I like the old gentleman, but I'm afraid he's going to cost me money. And I did feel like this is a very nervous electorate right now. Because of the Trump presidency. So I think that that the conversation that is being had about healthcare is very one-sided. The way that when the moderators at the debates ask Bernie, "Well, how are you going to pay for it?" It seems like there's not an actual real conversation happening about healthcare. Well, how are the other plans going to be paid for? How are we paying for what we have now? You know, it's like it's just this one question. But I also do think the electorate if I can summarize it, I'd say it's like we have a very jittery electorate.
That is a good way of putting it. And one debate after another, and the primary election still in their very, very early stages. And it seems as though everyone is trying to be a political pundit to predict the future and where all voters will go, you know, one way or another, add into it corporate media framing of issues. And you get a confusing field that we try to make sense of every single day, and that reporters like you are doing your bit to straighten out as well. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us. Give out a website where people can read your reporting.
It's www.capitalinmaine.com. And really, I so appreciate the work that you do, Sonali. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you. Likewise, Jessica. My guest has been Jessica Goodhart, senior reporter for Capital in Maine. We've been talking about the report she's working on. It's a year-long report called The United States of Inequality, 2020 and the Great Divide. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.